This is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, Episode 20, The Classifications of Bread. Hello and welcome to the Stella Culinary School Podcast. My name is Jacob. In this episode, we will be discussing the classifications of bread and how you can understand the way the breads are classified and use this to your advantage in creating your own unique recipes without having to follow someone else's. Also, we will be discussing the science behind the bulk fermentation process and how you can better understand the extraction of flavor from wheat. And this is the Stella Culinary School Podcast, found online at stellaculinary.com. My name is Jacob, and we are chugging right along in our bread series. And in today's episode, we will be discussing the classifications of bread as our featured segment. But before we get into that, we're going to talk about some of the underlying science behind bulk fermentation. I promise we won't get too crazy into it today because there's really no need. But really, this episode is here to lay the foundation for episode 21, which we will be discussing one of my all-time favorite culinary topics, which is sourdough starters. And so we will be going over sourdough starters. We will be going over pre-ferments and talking a little bit more in depth as you know what it takes to make great sourdough bread. And we'll probably spend at least two episodes on sourdough alone, depending upon how much ground we can cover and how many questions there are. And speaking of questions, I sent out a tweet and a little post on Facebook, saying, hey, getting ready to record the episode 20 of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Does anyone have any bread questions? And wowzers, yeah, we got a lot of bread questions. So stay tuned for that because we will be answering all of your bread questions at the end of this episode. In previous episodes, we did discuss bulk fermentation a little bit. We kind of glossed over it because it is not a large subject, but there are some finer details that we just really didn't have time to go into in the previous episodes on bread. And understanding some of what's going on during the bulk fermentation process will allow you to make better decisions in the future when you try and tackle some more advanced techniques, specifically when we get into using pre-ferments, using sourdough starters. And it'll also allow you to understand why a pre-ferment is able to produce a much more flavorful loaf than just mixing everything together and letting it go. And that is all because of how you prolong and control the bulk fermentation process, because fermentation is where all of the flavor is formed. When we talked about in last episode, where this sort of magical transformation that occurs when you mix flour, salt, water, and yeast together, and the dough becomes alive, and this powdery substance, this flour that tasted almost like nothing before you started, under the right conditions and in the hands of someone who knows what they're doing, can turn into this beautifully complex piece of food. So what is this magic and where does this magic occur? Well, this magic is the processes that are happening during your bulk fermentation process, right after the initial mixing of the flour, water, and the yeast. So there are three main reactions that are going on during any given bread fermentation. You have the yeast fermentation, you have the enzymatic reactions that are going on in there, and then you have the lactobacilli fermentation, which is more of a concern in sourdough breads. But you can even have some lactobacilli fermentation occurring in a regular bread without a sourdough starter if you prolong the bulk fermentation long enough. But for the most part, today what we're going to focus on, because the lactobacilli falls more under the sourdough category, today we're going to focus on more the enzymatic reactions that occur during the bulk fermentation process, right when you mix that flour and water together. Now, like we've talked about before, you only want to use enough yeast to get the job done. You just a little, you know, just enough to leaven it. And so the more time you have, the more patience you have with your bulk fermentation process, the less amount of yeast you can use. Now, the reason why is because too much yeast will exhaust the sugars present in the bread dough, giving you a slightly alcohol aftertaste. Now, when the yeast exhausts the sugars available in the dough, it will actually start to cannibalize itself, creating a byproduct called glutathione, which has an ammonia-like smell and aftertaste. And you'll see this a lot, too, in sourdough starters that go too long between feedings, right? But also, this same thing can happen if you add too much yeast to your flour and or to your dough mixture and it rises too rapidly. The yeast population is basically going to consume all of its available food and then, just like the Donner Party, kind of turn it on itself and cannibalize each other, which, you know, leaves a bad taste in your mouth. Also, while your yeast is actively fermenting, there's enzymatic reactions occurring within the dough itself that will improve its flavor and its quality. Now, if the fermentation process is allowed to progress too quickly, then not only will you risk all the undesirable side effects that the yeast is, that concerns the yeast, but the enzymes within the dough itself won't have enough time to reach their full potential. Now, just a quick refresher, enzymes catalyze a select chemical reaction that would otherwise take a much longer time to complete. Enzymes are basically the superchargers of the chemical world. So a lot of the time when you see food enzymes at work and you just in your daily life, it's in the degradation of food, in the spoiling of food, in the oxidation of food, the changing of the colors. We discussed in our blanching series a long time ago, I believe it was episode 4 of the Stellar Culinary School podcast, we were talking about the chlorophyllase enzyme, which was responsible at a certain temperature within the simmering that if you allowed your vegetables, your green vegetables to stay within that zone too long, that this chlorophyllase enzyme starts to supercharge and starts to turn your green vegetables a drab gray color. So a lot of the times, like we talked about, these enzymes are breaking down your food, and that's what they do. But sometimes you can use this to your advantage. Because here's the thing, generally speaking, fermenting food is bad, right? Except for some rare cases, you know, with bread baking, beer making, wine. There's some food that you want to ferment, like kimchi and some of those god-awful Scandinavian dishes where they bury that fish. But for the most part, the fermentation of food is, generally speaking, a bad thing. But let's talk about a singular starch molecule as an example, right? And this starch molecule happens to make up your flour, which you're using to bake your bread. Now, on a molecular level, that starch molecule is a complex carbohydrate, which is really nothing more than a chain of three or more sugar molecules that are linked together. And you can visualize this complex carbohydrate as this chain of sugars, and you have a bunch of different single sugar chains that are kind of tied up and wound up together, kind of like a big messy knot, you know, when you get like an extension cord in a jumbled mess or like a big ball of twine sort of rolled together. Now, if you take this sort of jumbled knot mess of singular sugar molecules that is a complex carbohydrate or the starch molecule, and you run this through an enzymatic reaction, it will quickly be separated out into its individual threads, so to speak, releasing the individual sugar molecules that can now be used as fuel for the yeast fermentation, flavor for our palate because we like sweet things, and the browning of our bread's crust. It is actually these singular sugars that will brown during the baking process. Now, given enough time, almost all forms of food can be reduced to simple sugars, making them fermentable, which is a large part of why most all food will spoil on you, given enough time. Now, when fermentation occurs, or when you're fermenting your bread, basically you're catalyzing, you're taking advantage of this flour being broken down or spoiling. I mean, it's not technically like turning into something rancid that you can't eat, but a lot of the times, you know, when food spoils, when it breaks down and goes bad on you, it's because these enzymes are breaking it down and fermenting them. Well, the same thing has happened with bread, but it just so happens that you can eat this spoiling kind of food. So this enzymatic reaction is mainly perpetuated or mainly caused by the enzyme amylase, right? So usually when you see a word that ends in ase, A-S-E, it is signifying an enzyme that reacts with a sugar that ends in ose, O-S-E. And there's a whole other class of, you know, enzymes that react with proteins. But, you know, right now we're just going to kind of simplify and talk about, you know, enzymes reacting with sugars. In this case, you know, the sugars that you're going to use to bake bread. So the enzyme amylase is going to react with the sugar amylose. And amylose is actually a category of sugar that you'll find in your flour. And this category of sugar contains glucose, sucrose, fructose, maltose, and dextrose. Now, during fermentation, these singular, or some of these singular sugars, most notably glucose and to a small extent fructose, are what feed your yeast. It's what your yeast thrive on, while some of the other sugars are used for browning and some of the other sugars are used for flavor, right? And these yeast, the singular sugars are broken out of the complex starch molecules and used as food by the yeast during the fermentation process. Now, this enzymatic process can't happen until water is added to the flour, which is another reason why autolyse is a nice step in the bread making process. And we talked about this in the last episode, where the autolyse step is you generally mix your flour and your water together, and you allow it to sit for about 20 to 30 minutes before kneading it or adding any other secondary ingredients. Because not only is it going to hydrate the flour and allow you to knead the flour easier and knead it for less time, which in its own right is going to give you a better flavored loaf of bread, but also it's allowing these enzymatic reactions to occur. The amylose can go in and break down, the amylase can go and break down the amylose and start to break out all the singular sugars and give your yeast something to feed on when you actually go and you add it in at the end of the autolyse process. Now, also during the milling process of most flour, some of the starch molecules are destroyed, freeing a tiny amount of simple sugars, which is why yeast can activate when being mixed directly into a dough, and the yeast can also survive and reproduce based upon the small amount of simple sugars already present in your flour until the amylose the amylase enzymes have had enough time to liberate the simple sugars from the evil grasp of the complex carbohydrates and live happily ever after. And this understanding of this enzymatic reaction that's going on during the bulk fermentation process, or basically as soon as you mix flour and water together, is going to lay the foundation in the future. And it really is the cornerstone of making great bread. Because in the future, we're going to talk about, you know, poulet starters and pre-ferments and, you know, using old dough, all these things to give a better structure and a better flavor to your bread. And it's funny because people have this sort of sense sometimes that you can bake bread quickly, and you can. I mean, what's crazy is people see like this thing where you have to say, you know, well, it's got to bulk ferment for 4 hours, and then you got to maybe leave it overnight, then maybe you can form it. And they get so just caught up in the fact that you're telling me it takes half a day to maybe, a full 24 hours to bake a good loaf of bread. It's like, yes, but it's not like you're, you know, pulling an all-nighter and sitting there kneading it constantly. There's a lot of, you know, passive time in the bread baking process. And once you understand why you have these pauses and why you want to slow things down, you know, you can break up your steps and you can make bread relatively easy, and you can make fabulous bread relatively easy, and you can even make it work into your schedule more conveniently by understanding how to stall or retard fermentation or stall or retard the proofing process and how to get these enzymes going. And you just have to plan for it. So you can't just come home at 5 o'clock at night after work and say, hey, I want to bake from scratch a great loaf of bread and have it ready for dinner at 7:30. It's not going to happen. But if you can commit to the bread baking process and commit to thinking ahead a little bit, you can very easily, which is, you know, 5-10 minutes here and there throughout a 24-hour span, or even, you know, a 6-12-hour span, make a wonderful loaf of bread that's going to be really hard for anyone else with a lesser passion to ever reproduce. in today's featured segment, we will be talking about bread classifications. And this is going to be important because once you understand how bread is classified, it's going to fill in some of the gaps that we've left and allow you to start creating your own formulas. Because you've heard me preach this time and time again, but I'm going to preach some more. Cooking is all about formulas and technique. That's it. It's all about ratios and technique. And that's what separates cooks from chefs, in my opinion. And there's nothing wrong with following a recipe, but if you really want to create your own recipes and understand what's going on, be able to troubleshoot your own recipes, you need to understand the ratios and how they interact, and you need to understand the techniques. So for bread, your basic formula for any bread dough is classification plus technique plus flavors give you a specific type of bread. And you can simplify this even further, which is classification plus technique equals bread. And so we'll talk about this a little bit more here in a second. We'll revisit this formula. But first, let's sort of blow through some of the different ways to classify breads. And there's no right or wrong way to classify breads. The classification of bread is more just to give you a proper definition of what you're trying to attain. Some forms of bread, especially in European-style bakeries, they like to, especially some of the more classic breads, they like to designate them or classify them by hydration rate, right? We were talking about, the baker's percentage and your hydration rate in the last couple of episodes. So for them, they do a, stiff dough, standard dough, and a rustic dough. And these are definitions or these classifications are all based upon hydration. So the stiff dough is about 50 to 57% hydration rate, which is extremely stiff. And it's going to give you this kind of chewy texture with a really dense crumb, and this is good for a couple of specialty breads, mainly bagels and pretzels, and this is where you're going to be using a stiff dough. Now, standard doughs are about 57 to 65% hydration, and these are your European-style breads, sandwich breads, French bread, dinner rolls, will usually contain about 57 to 65% hydration, and then you have what they call their rustic doughs, which is anything above a 65% hydration rate, and this is going to encompass things like ciabatta and focaccia. Lots of artisan-style loaves will fall into this category. And until very recently, except for a few rogue bakers in France, most of your breads would never go above 65% hydration. It just wasn't their style. The more rustic-style breads with the higher hydration rates were mainly used in Italy for focaccias and some forms of pizza, and also the ciabatta loaf, which is, that nice little slipper, and that gives you that beautiful, open, airy crumb that you see a lot with. That's kind of, the signature mark of focaccia and ciabatta. Now, in my opinion, because we talked about this a little bit before, European-style flours are slightly different. They hydrate slightly different than American-style flours. So the way I like to break down stiff dough, standard dough, and rustic is, for me, really anything that's at around 62% or below, that's a stiff dough for me, especially if you're using an American-style bread flour that has a high gluten content around 13.5%. If you mix that dough or if you mix that flour with a 62% hydration, it's going to be fairly stiff regardless. Standard doughs for me is, standard bread dough is usually about the 65 to 68% hydration rate. And again, this is just how I classify this is how I like to think about them. Because when you're using bread flour, which is predominantly how I bake most of my breads, the 65 to 68% hydration rate is going to give you a workable dough that's fairly easy to form. You might need a slight dusting of flour. You could use some spray release in the forming process. But it's going to hold its structure. You don't have to use any sort of specialty handling techniques to get it to hold its structure during proofing and during baking. And then high hydration starts at anywhere above 68%. But most commonly speaking, especially in sort of the artisan bakery movement or artisan bread movement that's going on in America right now, high hydration is really considered to start around 75%, even though this kind of leaves like a no man's land between 68 and and 75% hydration. But, you know, 70% I think is a great starting point for people who want to get into, you know, high hydration, low. It's that nice open area crumb, the no knead method, which we will be talking about in our sourdough episode. And also we will be doing a video on it. The 70% hydration mark is a great place to start. Now, you can also classify your bread based upon its fat content. And this is very common in a lot of professional baking manuals. You'll see this a lot in, you know, culinary schools where they talk about, you know, lean dough, enriched dough, and rich doughs. So the way that you break this down is a lean dough contains very little fat, and that's why they call it lean. And generally speaking, you know, a lean dough can have a tiny bit of fat in it, and that tiny bit of fat will help with the browning process. It'll help with extensibility in certain kinds of breads. But for the most part, anything over 5% fat content by the baker's percentage is going to affect your gluten structure and sort of the structure of the overall loaf. And that's really the separating line between a lean dough and an enriched dough is when that fat content that you add to the bread, when it starts to actually affect the structure of your bread by making it more tender, by shortening those gluten strands, then is no longer a lean dough, is now, at the very least, an enriched dough. And so what happens is when you add fat to any given bread dough, it will actually shorten your gluten strands. And this is why a lot of the baking fat, like, you know, vegetable shortening or animal shortening, is called shortening. And there, you see this a lot in biscuits recipes, because they want the biscuit to be nice and tender. And one of the ways that you get a nice tender biscuit is by using a lower content of gluten in your flour, which we talked about in episode 18, I believe, and also by further shortening those gluten strands by adding fat. And that's how you get that nice tender texture. And so the enriched dough, you will normally have the addition of some form of fat, or not normally, it has to have an addition of some sort of fat at a baker's percentage rate of higher than 5%. And common fats would be milk, eggs, butter. Sometimes there's a little bit of sugar in there to add a tiny hint of sweetness. And so there's enough of this fat to tenderize the crumb and give it a good sort of enriched flavor. And this enriched dough, you'll see this used a lot in you know, sandwich breads, dinner rolls, because you want, with a sandwich bread specifically, you want bread that has still, you know, a decent amount of structure to it, where it's not, you know, falling apart or super tender. But also, too, sometimes you want to use a nice, you know, rustic dough, like a ciabatta roll or something for your bread. But that sometimes that those rustic doughs can become a little bit too chewy for your application, right? And they can take over the sandwich. Instead of allowing the ingredients inside the sandwich to shine, you know, now the bread is kind of taking over the whole texture and mouthfeel of each bite. So you can use a slightly bit of an enriched dough for your sandwich loaves. And this is, you know, basic white breads and, you know, French rolls, things like that you'll find in sandwich shops are normally enriched doughs. Now, once you add more than 20% fat to any given enriched dough, it is no longer an enriched dough. It is now a rich dough. And this covers things like brioche, some forms of holiday breads, croissants, danishes and pastries. And also within this rich dough category is a subcategory of laminated breads. And these are croissants, Danish puff pastries, some forms of biscuits. And a laminated bread is where the fat, normally butter, is laminated between layers of the dough using a series of folds. And you roll the dough out, you fold it back in, and this creates this, you know, massive amounts of microscopic layers that allow you to have that beautiful flaky texture that, you know, is very desirable in croissants and danishes and biscuits. Now, you also have the classification of flatbreads, and flatbreads can be yeasted or unyeasted, and one distinct attribute is they have limited heights. And this is going to cover your pizzas, focaccias, crackers, your lavash. All these things are considered flatbreads. And when you limit the height of your bread, obviously it's going to have an effect on your texture and your overall flavor perception. You know, I mean, think for a second of taking a thick slice of French bread and then making a pizza with it, you know, your tomato sauce and your cheese and all that sort of thing. And then taking an actual proper pizza dough and stretching it out, making it nice and thin, and placing your ingredients on top. The overall, even if all the other ingredients are the same, except for the base, which is one pizza dough and one French bread, you're going to have a completely different texture, a completely different flavor experience. So flatbreads are good for anything that you want to spread on top. You know, right now we're currently serving a nice seeded lavash with one of our cheese courses at the restaurants. So that is just a classification to take into consideration. Now, you also will commonly hear things about the direct dough or the straight dough method. And we talked a little bit about this when we were talking about, we'll be talking about more about this when we talk about pre-ferments, but when we were talking about autolyse, right, where you mix some of the ingredients together and then you mix the other ingredients together. And that's really all a direct dough or a straight dough method is doughs that have been, a direct dough is basically doughs that have been mixed without the use of a pre-ferment or by pre-mixing any ingredients. And you'll usually see this with enriched doughs, right? And this is us combining classifications because a direct or a straight dough method is you're quickly leavening the bread, right? You're not allowing for a ton of enzymatic reaction to occur unless you retard fermentation. So a lot of your flavor is going to be coming from your fat content, right? Your eggs, your butter, maybe like some seasonings like vanilla or sugar. So if you're trying to make a rustic bread with the direct method, then it's not going to come out that good because you're not going to have time for the enzymatic reactions to occur during the bulk fermentation process. It's going to happen too quickly. See how we kind of brought that full circle? So as opposing the direct or the straight dough method, you have the indirect or the sponge method. And this is where autolyse is used and also even more specifically pre-ferments are used. And just to give you sort of a sneak peek of what a pre-ferment is, it's basically mixing some flour and the water together, spiking it with some yeast, and letting it sit anywhere from 12 to 72 hours. And then you have this pre-fermented dough where all this enzymatic reactions occur, and then you can take this dough and pitch it into more flour, water, salt, and make a finished loaf with it. And because you have this pre-ferment, because you did this indirect or sponge method, you're going to have a much better flavored end product, which is very important when making lean doughs because you don't have the addition of fat and sugar, which will also kind of mask and add some flavors. Now, you also the final classification is yeast type, right? The yeast strain that you use. And this really is kind of can be broken down into three separate subcategories of yeast type, which is commercially yeasted, natural yeast or naturally leavened, and unyeasted bread, which is going to sometimes contain chemical leavening, like soda breads, some forms of crackers. And also the unyeasted bread that has the chemical leavening will be, you'll have a subcategory, which is called quick breads. And quick breads are muffins, biscuits, most forms of pancakes, right? There are some forms that do use yeast. And they're called quick breads because they're ready to bake literally after mixing. And again, because you're not allowing the dough to sit or the batter to sit, because quick breads are normally batter-based, but the enzymatic reactions aren't recurring and you don't have any yeast in there that will add its own little natural flavor. Quick bread, you're never going to see a quick bread recipe where it's like, flour, water, baking soda, baking powder, a little bit of salt and bake, right? It'd be the dullest bread that you ever eat in your life. So all that flavor in the bread is coming from the added ingredients, like your sugar, your blueberries, your spices, whatever sort of muffin or quick bread that you're making is coming from, there's normally some fat in there, and it's coming from the texture and the actual additional flavors. So those are the major classifications for bread. So let's kind of go through and let's relook at our formula once again and see if we can kind of, come up with certain things in our head, right? We just kind of right off the cuff. So again, our formula is classification plus technique plus flavors equals a specific type of bread. So let's just say I want to make a pancake. Well, pancake would definitely fall in the high hydration dough and into the batter category. And anytime you have a hydration rate of more than 100%, it's now technically not a dough. It's considered a batter, right? So, but we'll just call it a high hydration dough. And I'm making a batter. But how am I going to leaven this? Am I going to add any sort of fat or flavors? Well, yes. I mean, pancakes were going to have some sort of fat. Why? Because pancakes, you want them to be tender. You don't want them to be chewy like a loaf of bread. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to make probably an enriched batter, and you can even take it as far as making it a rich dough batter. And then, am I going to yeast it? Well, yeah, I could if I really wanted to, but that takes a lot of time, and I already have a bunch of flavor in there, so I don't really need to yeast it. So I'm going to drop it into a quick bread category and use my chemical leaveners like baking soda and baking powder. The same thing can be said for I want to make a basic rustic country loaf, right? And normally, a bread that's called a country loaf has a nice open, airy crumb, has a nice chewy texture, a crackly crust, some form of a little addition of whole wheat to give it a more hearty flavor. So I'm going to say to myself, okay, well, I want to make this country loaf. I don't want it to have any fat in it because I want it to be a lean dough because I want it to have a nice chewy texture. I don't want it to be tender, right? And I understand, too, that to get that nice open airy crumb, I need to have a higher hydration rate. So it needs to be at least above 68%. I'm going to, hit the easy mark of 70%. And I want to add a little bit of whole wheat flour, but really not all that much. I just want to add enough for color and a little bit of additional flavor, but I don't want to add so much to where it starts making my loaf dense. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to add, maybe about for every, like a 10-to-1 ratio of whole wheat to my bread flour. So I'll do, just to make it easy, I'll, weigh out 900 grams of bread flour and add 100 grams of whole wheat flour. And then because I want to do a, nice open airy crumb, but I don't want to, have to, handle the dough as much, or not even that. I don't want to have to go through the pain of, using a high hydration loaf and all the different techniques that go into that, especially since we haven't discussed them yet. I'm just going to, add the 700 grams of water to give me a 70% hydration rate, 2% salt, because we know our salt content for all breads range from 1% to 3% based upon the last episodes that we were talking about the baked percentage. So 2% salt content. And after today, talking about, a nice long and slow bulk fermentation, I'm not even going to measure my yeast. I'm going to add just a couple of, pinches to the water and allow it to mix and allow it to naturally just kind of slowly come up and ferment. And then from here, you can use any number of finishing techniques. I mean, you can turn it into a slipper and make a ciabatta, even though ciabatta is typically a little higher hydration rate, normally in the 80% range. You can make a higher hydration baguette with it, like we showed in the baguette video technique. But in that technique, we're using a 65% hydration loaf. So we had a tiny bit of an open texture in our crumb. But now this, this country style loaf, if you form it into a baguette and you bake it just like I showed you in the baguette video technique, it's going to have a more open airy crumb. It's going to have a little bit more complex flavors because of the wheat flour. So this is just to give you an example, sort of a mind exercise of when you understand the basics of bread classification, when you understand the baker's percentage and you understand the various techniques behind creating bread, then you can start just almost just freewheeling it, right? You don't have to follow a certain bread recipe. And you can also look at a certain bread recipe and automatically know if it's going to suit your needs. So now you have the tools, and especially when we start reinforcing this information with some upcoming bread videos, now you have the tools to picture an end result. Hey, I want my loaf to taste like this. I want it to look like this. I want to have this kind of texture. And then you can use the information that you have to obtain that sort of texture. Do you want a crackly crust? Well, then you need steam. Do you want a tender crumb? Well, then you need fat. Do you want open airy crumb? Well, then you need a high hydration rate. And it really is that simple. So at this point, it's just a matter of trial and error. And then, watching some of the video techniques and the video recipes that I'll be releasing shortly. And then you now have the firm foundation of what makes bread what it is. So now, in the following episode, we can start talking about sourdough starters and sourdough bread and pre-ferments, which will, if you're not used to using them, if you've never made bread using a natural levain or a natural starter before, will absolutely rock your world. You will be able to create some amazing bread, and you'll be a rock star, trust me. I mean, I've been doing a lot of trial and error. I've been doing a lot of testing in my regular ovens at the restaurant, because most of our bread is baked in a wood fire oven. So I've been trying to recreate the Stella bread that we do in the wood fire oven, and I shot a video last week, and very, very happy with the end result. And so I will be releasing that video after next episode when we talk about sourdough starters and pre-ferments. What would my contribution be? Most definitely political, subliminal, partially, hardly any filler with that about the process. I'm thinking progress over literary garbage, harness. These words sicken me, the future set. I regret even when dealing with the corporate structure. Power is given up to those who repeat the beat over sheet. I got a ton of questions this episode about bread baking. So we're going to try and burn through these almost sort of rapid style question taking and see if I can't burn through all these questions and give you guys a better understanding. Because, you know, I figure if one of you has this question, there's probably a handful of you out there that would benefit from the question, whether you know it or not. So let's jump right in. First question comes through Jay via email, and he says, Jay, I'm sorry, you posted this to last episode's show notes. And he says, Hammerlin and Mark Sinclair talk about the final dough temperature after mixing. Sinclair even explains how to measure the flour temp and calculate the temp of water needed to get the desired final temperature in the dough. This is one area I've been quite lax in and may explain some of the variations in my bread. What is your take on final dough temperature? Well, my take is I don't take the temperature. This really is a feel thing. And what happens is, sometimes, and I'm guilty of this too, sometimes people when they're writing recipes, they get caught up in all the different details and I guess controls, and trying to put certain controls on, because you want nothing less when writing a recipe or writing a technique for someone to go and try that recipe and be like, wow, that was really garbage. Like, this guy has no idea what he's doing, you know? And because there are so many variables in the kitchen and in bread baking, I think that's why a lot of recipes will call for you to take the final dough temperature, the internal temperature, because if it's at a certain temperature, then you know that you at least have yeast activity going on in that dough, and then you can, then he can tell you, you know, once it hits this temperature, allow it to bulk ferment for this long, and you can do a, you know, a very easy rise. I mean, you can predict where, you know, how long it's going to take for that bread to rise, and that's the you know, sort of the curse of writing a cookbook or, you know, writing a recipe, is people want something that they can glance at real quick and just try and replicate. And that's why, you know, I talk about, you know, I mean, by the time we're done with the bread lecture series alone, just the lectures, you know, all easily have spent, you know, 5-6 hours talking to you about bread and technique and, you know, how to troubleshoot recipes, where, you know, in a recipe that has maybe, you know, 300, you know, words in it, generally they're not going to be able to cover all the different variables. So instead, what they do is they say, you know, use this temperature of water, use this specific kind of yeast, use this kind of salt, make sure your dough reaches this internal temperature. But really, it's all about feeling, and you can tell when your dough is alive and when it's not. And you can also just mix your dough and throw it in your refrigerator. So the internal dough temperature isn't really telling you anything except for how quickly your bread is going to rise, right? But once you make a couple batches of bread within your own kitchen and you get used to your environment, you'll be able to pretty much figure that out just by touching your dough and feeling it after, you know, 30 minutes of fermentation. You'll know right where you're at. Now, the next question comes from Julius, and Julius says, I absolutely love your site and the tutorials. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You guys don't need to hear this stuff. Let's get to the question. I use a new razor blade each time, but sometimes the blade drags rather than cuts the dough. This causes a loss of some of the rising of the bread. Can you give me any advice on doing a proper doc scoring? I'm an eye surgeon and have no trouble using a blade in surgery. Julius. Well, very cool. It's kind of amazing how kind of what smart people listen to just some dude who talks about bread and flour and stuff. But to answer your question, it sounds like to me that you're catching that back corner of your razor, and even though you might think you're not, you probably are, because that's just what it sounds like, where it's snagging. And so what happens is when you're doing docking marks or scoring your bread using a razor, you want to tilt, if you're right-handed, and just assume for a second you're right-handed, you want to tilt the front left corner of your razor blade towards your dough when you're docking it. And you want to make sure that, you know, while you're tilting that front left corner, obviously the back left corner will be tilting away. Because what happens if your razor blade is too perpendicular to the actual dough, or if it's not at an angle, if you're not angling that front corner towards it, then as you're doing your docking, as you're doing your scoring marks, especially when you're moving down an elongated loaf, like a batard or like a baguette or like a French loaf, that back corner will snag on the dough and start to rip it really quick instead of actually giving you some nice clean slices. Now, if that's not the case, if you're if it seems like your dough is maybe too moist and it's sticking to your razor blade, you can easily just hit it with a little bit of a pan release spray, you know, like some Pam or any sort of oil-based or fat-based spray or any sort of nonstick cooking spray, and you just spray your razor with that right before docking or slicing your dough. And the next question comes from Javier via Facebook, and Javier asks, what's the best method for injecting steam during the proofing process in a home environment? So I assume you're talking about, you know, giving your bread a moist environment to proof and rise after the formation. And the easiest way to do this is in an oven, and at least in a household kitchen. Some people will build cabinets that can hold steam. So anything that you can, like, you know, shut a door on that will lock together and you don't mind there being steam in it, you can use that as well. But one of the easiest solutions for this, if you want to inject some steam into the proofing process, which will, you know, keep a crust from forming on your bread while it's proofing, and also hasten the proofing process, it'll speed it up slightly, you can just place your bread in your oven that is turned off, and then have a tray of, you know, just at the bottom of boiling water. And you just place that in there, and the boiling water will have enough steam to, you know, moisten that environment, raise the humidity, and also raise the temperature in that oven a little bit. Now, if your home oven, which is very rare, but just in case it does, if your home oven has a gas pilot light, it might be slightly too hot. But usually, even most gas ovens in the home environment are electric start, so you don't have to worry about that. But that's just something to take into consideration. But you won't really know until you know, give it a shot and give it a try. So, you know, steam your, proof your baguettes or proof your bread with a little bit of steam action in your home oven, and you should be good to go. Next question comes from Corey via Facebook. Corey asks if I might have a recipe or be able to help him on how to use blue Stilton, which is a kind of cheese, with ginger and mango in a simple bread. Thanks. Yeah, I would just make a nice bun and spread on the Stilton and mango, maybe bake the ginger in it. I don't know. I mean, the flavor combinations aren't really one that I would pick out of thin air. So it really depends upon the texture. So let's look at it. So we were talking about enriched doughs, right, earlier. So if you add some Stilton cheese, which is high fat content, if you add that to your bread dough, it's going to give you more of a dense texture. Ginger can be added as a flavor without any sort of, you know, affecting the texture too much, especially if you add it to your water and kind of steep it and then remove it later, or you finally mince it, it'll give you a nice, gingery loaf of bread. And then you can always just incorporate it into an enriched dough. So if you want it for whatever reason, if you want to have ginger and mango and the blue Stilton baked directly into your dough, I would just follow a basic enriched dough recipe, because you're basically making a, you know, almost like a version of a spiced loaf that you would see around the holidays. So take an enriched dough recipe, maybe leave a tiny bit of the fat out, maybe like 5% of the fat out, and you add back in your Stilton blue cheese, which has a nice strong flavor, and some finely diced mango, some finely minced ginger, and then allow it to go through the bulk fermentation process, form it, round it, and then bake it off. And because you are adding the blue cheese and also the ginger and also the mango, which will make your loaf a little bit more dense and heavy, you will have a more dense crumb. So I recommend doing really small, like dinner rolls, and rounding them off and baking them in that fashion instead of trying to make, you know, one huge large loaf, which would sort of flatten out on you and not have very good structure. So dinner rolls are the way to go, and an enriched dough recipe with about 15% fat content and your cheese is what I would recommend. Now, the next one comes from Rob via Facebook, and Rob asks, what's the surefire way to always get a razor-thin crust in a conventional home oven? Steam, 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 steam is my answer, and that's why in the baguette video, I show you how to enclose your baguettes in a, in a hotel pan because steaming isn't enough. You need a close proximity steam. What happens is your ovens vent very quickly, and in ratio to the actual volume inside your oven, the cubic volume, your baguettes aren't getting, or any sort of bread that you want that nice razor-thin crackly crust on, they're not having enough exposure to steam. So even if it looks like your oven is full of steam, it's unless it's sealed really, really well, there's a lot of different room in that area for that steam to run and hide and not be in direct contact with the baguette. So the best way, in my opinion, is to somehow enclose it. Now, something I've been actually experimenting with for a while, and I've just now kind of started to get it down, and I'm going to shoot a video on it in a little bit. But just to give you a sneak peek, if you're using a baking stone, you can still use the actual hotel pan method, but just reversing it. And what I've been playing around with is taking a French loaf or some high hydration baguettes, put it on the baking stone in the oven that's already been preheated with the oven, give it a quick squirt with some water, and then turn the hotel pan upside down on top of the baguettes or the bread, and let them steam covered for about 10 minutes, the first 10 minutes of the initial baking phase. And it does a fairly good job of not only holding in the steam, but like we talked about, keeping that steam within close proximity to the crust, because it's not just enough to have some steam in there in contact with your crust, but it needs to be saturating that crust for at least the first 8 to 10 minutes of the baking process to really produce that nice crackly razor-thin crust consistently. Next question comes from Caesar via Twitter. How do you improve the nutritional value of regular bread without diminishing the gluten properties of the flour? Are there any healthier versions? Well, yes, I would recommend starting with a nice high-quality unbleached flour to begin with. And then you can start adding your whole wheat flour. And what I've found is that if you go above 20% whole wheat in any given bread dough recipe, it will start to affect your gluten structure. Your bread will become more dense. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but if you're looking to do a nice, light, open, airy loaf, then the wheat or the whole wheat flour will have an effect on that. So I would start in the 20% range of, so if you're going to use 1,000 grams of bread flour total or 1,000 grams of flour total, it would be 800 grams of bread flour and 200 grams of whole wheat flour, and see where that gets you. And then you can slowly start ratcheting up. You can add some whole oats. You can, roll the top in oats to add some more fiber. You can add more whole wheat flour, allowing your dough to moisten and sort of sit in a sponge stage without any yeast, where you do a prolonged autolyse for a few hours up until, as long as a day, is also going to help that enzymatic reaction start to break down some of the more complex sugars within the whole wheat and give you a better texture. And we will talk more about whole wheats in the future, but once you start getting above that 20% range of whole wheat flour in your overall bread dough, you are going to have a difficult time with having an open, airy crumb, and you will have a little bit more of a dense texture. It's just the nature of whole wheat breads. Doesn't mean you can't make them taste great, but it is what it is. Now, if this is something you really want to get into and you are very interested in exploring, there is a great book. I'm a big fan. I've mentioned this before, of Peter Reinhardt, and he has a great book called Whole Grain Bread. I would highly recommend that to anyone who wants to get into baking whole grain bread. The next one comes from Darcy, and Darcy asks, should I use the convection feature on my oven or just regular bake? Does the rack position matter? Well, all convection does, you have your conventional ovens and your convection ovens. Convection just has a fan that circulates the hot air in your oven, which diminishes hot spots. So in a normal oven, you need to be a little bit more vigilant about, moving your sheet pan or your bread, whatever rack it's on, moving it from top to bottom and rotating it front to back, one or two times throughout the cooking process. convection ovens diminish this because, you know, it's constantly circulating the heated air within the oven, which is going to give you a more even cooking time and a more even browning. But this doesn't mean that it solves the problem completely. The front of your oven will always be colder than the back of your oven, so there you still will need to look at it and rotate it. Also, every oven is different as far as which rack you want to use, and it usually depends upon where your heating element is. In a lot of electric ovens, the heating element is on the top. In a lot of gas ovens, the heating element is on the bottom. So your hot spot for an electric oven is towards the heating element on the top, and your hot spot for a gas oven is on the bottom. So generally speaking, if you're only utilizing one tray in your oven or one rack, right smack dab in the middle is perfect because it's going to give you the most even heating. And then, you know, if you're using multiple trays or multiple racks, even if you're using a convection oven with that fan to cycle through, you're still going to have to rotate the bread top to bottom and front to back. Now, the final question comes from Monica G via Twitter, and she asks, stand mixer or muscle power? What do you prefer? And I used to be more of a stand mixer kind of guy, to be honest with you. But now that I've figured out ways to mix bread without necessarily having to use a whole lot of muscle power, and this is even includes enriched doughs with low hydration rates, I prefer to hand mix. I find it kind of therapeutic. I also find it gives you a much better end result and an end texture. And I'm gonna release this video where I do my version of a country loaf that you can easily reproduce at home. And the sort of slapping and folding technique that I'll demonstrate is, kind of enjoyable to do, and it will very quickly bring together a cohesive piece of dough. And I can almost make a cohesive piece of dough quicker than you can in a stand mixer when you take into consideration the time that you got to, pull the mixer out, set the mixing bowl, and you got to break it down, you got to wash the mixing bowl. And so I prefer the hand kneading method. And as we release more videos on different types of breads and different kinds of techniques, I'm going to show you various methods for hand kneading that are going to allow you to produce a really nice bread. Now, if you have a stand mixer, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be using it. It's just the fact that not everyone does have a stand mixer. And, when I make these bread videos, I want to make sure that everyone who is capable of going out and buying flour and water and some eggs and some butter can make a nice, consistent loaf of bread. And that's it for this episode of the Stella Culinary School Podcast. Thank you once again for joining me. If you want to hit me up on Twitter, it's at Chef Jacob. Check out our Facebook page. You can go to facebook.com/Chef Jacob Burton or /Stella Culinary, both of which will get you into contact with me where you can ask me questions, get some answers. Also, I always recommend heading over to stellaculinary.com/forum. Lots of smart people hang out there, like-minded, just like you, who love to cook. You can get a lot of great questions answered there, and you can share some of your latest cooking exploits. And until next time, this is Jacob with the Stella Culinary School Podcast, reminding you to always cook and bake with passion. Next episode is sourdough breads and pre-ferments. Oh, I'm so excited. I hope you are, too. See you then.